to us, very helpful to us as a new committee. We don't see you anymore after last session. It was a baptism of fire. And that's going to help us to finalize our stress plan. What I would like to do for today, honorable members, is to dispense with the minutes before the FFC takes the floor, but there may be apologies, and let me check that first. Honorable Kwakwa from the UDM. Honorable Nyalunga from the ANC. Those are the two apologies we have. We decided after the threat plan that we should give the FFC an opportunity to make their submission on the 2015-16 division of revenue today. And they will be doing the presentation. Honorable members will have the opportunity to engage on the issues. We will prepare our response on the issues at a later stage. For today, we're ready. They have also given us the quick submission. I'm sure you can have this. Anybody else who doesn't have? Two honorable gentlemen don't have. Do we have more than for this? Thank you.
that question, and thank you, honorable members. I think maybe it's appropriate for me to start this off by thanking you, Jefferson, and your members for the support that you gave us last week during our Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Conference, which was really aimed at celebrating 20 years of the existence of the Financial and Fiscal Commission and the South African Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations System. I think there are some members here that I saw on a daily basis for the whole of the 3 days. And also some staff that were forever present, and we really appreciate and thank you for the support that you showed to us. And to you, Chairperson, thank you very much for giving time to come and chair the session. And I must say, you actually arrived before me, which was actually great. So thank you very much, members and staff and colleagues from the budget office. I can see that you've been a great friend. Thank you very much for the support. Now, what we want to do today is to give you a briefing on the Commission's submission for the 2015 Division of Revenue. The submission was tabled in Parliament on the, I think it must have been the 30th of May 2014. The submission is made in terms of the Constitution, Section 214. Section 9 of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act and Section 440 of the Non-Review Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. The overarching theme for the submission for 2015 is balancing fiscal sustainability with social economic impact. I think maybe it's important to talk about why balancing fiscal sustainability with socio-economic impact, in the sense that the South African economy has suffered from the global economic crisis that has been around about 2007 globally, and in South Africa around about 2008-2009. Now, at that time, when we looked at the numbers in the Commission, we did a bit of modeling exercise, and we did three types of scenarios around the impact of the global economic crisis. And the first scenario was what we called the business as usual, and we looked at the economic growth trajectory. And you would recall, members, that at that time we were coming from a period where everything was actually working so well for the South African economy. We were living with surpluses and the economy was doing very well. Now, we had that scenario, if everything happened in that particular fashion, what will happen? And then we had a scenario which was an optimistic one that basically said the crisis was a very temporary measure and it wasn't going to take such a long time for the globe to recover. And then we had what we call the pessimistic scenario. And the result of that pessimistic scenario is the one that we end up living with. The projection then told us that if the global economic crisis is a direct one, and the growth takes a long time to recover, South African economy will probably go back towards, it will never actually reach those levels that we were at that particular point in time, by 2015. And what is actually now becoming very clear is that that pessimistic scenario is the one that is actually turning out. And our pessimism at that point might have been quite conservative as well, because the way things are happening, that's some of the things that we never thought would happen. Like we now have a lot of domestic shocks in the form of strikes and a lot of other things that have happened that have actually worsened the scenario to such an extent that the economy is under pressure. Now going into 2015, with the numbers that the Census generated, which actually showed us that we still have very high levels of inequality, we still have only high levels of unemployment, and those are issues that must be taken care of by the state. Now, because the economy is not performing very well, it means the fiscal will be increasingly coming under pressure. Together with the fiscal consolidation that the government adopted in response to the global economic crisis, the growth in public spending has to be slowed down. It still grows, but it has slowed down. So it's no longer what we were used to. And as the fiscal comes more and more under pressure, it becomes more and more important and imperative that we then start borrowing, because the economy is not growing. So the issue around fiscal sustainability then speaks to the demands on the social program, the demands on the social program against an increasingly tight fiscal framework. And that basically means that we need to be very careful when we go out to borrow. We need to borrow to fund primarily matters that will generate benefits for the future generation. We can't borrow for consumption. But unfortunately, when the fiscal is under pressure, the temptation is there to do that kind of a thing. So the idea around this balancing of fiscal sustainability with socio-economic impact speaks to exactly the trade-off that needs to be made. And I think when we made the submission in 2009, we basically were very clear that as we slow down growth in public spending, we should be very careful not to impact negatively on our social programs, because they are designed to take care of the vulnerable part of our society. Now, the vulnerable part of our society has grown because of the unemployment challenge. So, again, the pressures are there, and so these are the kind of issues that we are looking at. Now, this submission is basically in four parts. The first part speaks to the macroeconomic and fiscal frameworks for inclusive growth. We look at the macroeconomic perspective and the fiscal framework. How does the economy look like going forward? So we don't really make any recommendations there. It's just facts about what we are actually dealing with. And then we look at the issue of public debt, the challenge of public debt. What we know is that our public debt responsibility, our debt service ratio, has actually grown quite substantially over the past 5 years. So we're not saying that there's anything that must raise alarm about the indebtedness of South Africa. But we must actually start thinking about the rate at which it grows and to what extent can we actually sustain that kind of rate of growth. So South Africa is not like a lot of countries that we know that during the global economic crisis probably had 101% debt to GDP ratio. So massive. South Africa is not at that point. But the issue is, can we control the rate at which our debt grows? So that the issue that we raise in the submission. We then also look at the social programs, and as I'm saying, you need to balance socio-economic impact with fiscal sustainability, which means even if we borrow, the money that we borrow must actually be benefiting, the impact must actually be felt on the vulnerable parts of our society. So you must not borrow to pay people's salaries, for example, to the Turkish Chinese. So you must not borrow so that we can consume. You must borrow so that we can build the world. And there's a story around the social programs which tries to demystify some of the stories that we know or that we hear about the sustainability of our social grant system and whether or not we are creating dependency for people and all of those types of issues. So we try to get into that and to get the macroeconomic impact of the social programs, in particular in reference to the social security grant. Now the second part of the submission talks about improving investment in educational health. And here I must say that the best investment that the country can ever make is in the health and education of its society. Now, that empowers people. And so we look at the utilization of resources, impact of resources that go into health and into education in terms of the outcomes that we get. Are we putting sufficient money? And if we are putting sufficient money, what is it that we're getting out of it? Then one has to look at those outcomes, and then we need to look at what the challenges are, because what we know is that the outcomes are not very good. What we also know is that there's quite a lot of money that is allocated to education and health. So what we're trying to get at is to see what the challenges are that result in those poor outcomes in health and education. So there's a story there. And then we started to look at the matter of food security, which is something that we never really have looked at in the past. We actually are aware that food security is a human right. It's also like part and parcel of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and we need to actually respond to it. Now, how we respond to it, we need to have somebody who takes responsibility for it so that we can be able to account to how countries perform in terms of this particular matter. It's important because without food security, even the investment in health and education might not actually generate any value. So it's something that we've brought into the work of the Commission, and we'll be looking at also going forward in the context of the whole rural development in terms of in aligning this to the national development plan. And then the third part of the submission looks at investment in infrastructure. Now, the investment in infrastructure that we're looking at is investment in infrastructure that allows for access to basic services. And the big part of that investment actually happens in the local government sphere. So we are looking at issues around financing municipal capital, improving public transport systems, the impact of electricity prices on municipalities, and then we're also looking at the issue of human settlement with regard to planning and funding for human settlement. The final section, which I will come back to after I've allowed my team to present on the first three sections, it relates to the impact of demarcation on municipal finances. So I'll come back and talk to that at the end of the presentation. But let me, Chairperson, introduce my research director on my left, Dr. Ramos Mapubu, who will take the first part of this submission, and we will share that with Alex Gowitz, who is my program manager for provincial budget. And then we've got a friend of ours, Alice. She's a student from UWC who we have accommodated, so she works with us. She's with us. And the other chair, head of fact, is Mr. Henry Epstein, our financial director. With permission, Chair, let me hand over to Dr. Mahfouz. Good morning, Honourable Members. Good morning, Chair. Now, I will go through the first part and second part of the submission, and my intention is not to go word by word on each of the chapters, but to pick on highlights so as to generate conversations around what we think are the key highlights from the chapters. Now, starting with the third chapter in the submission, the important thing to note is that we are painting a picture of South Africa in the next at least 3 years. So we're trying to characterize where we think the present issues for the next 3 years are going to be, and as a result, pick on issues likely to influence fiscal framework and eventually the allocation and appropriation for the next 3 years. And our starting point is to pick on the National Development Plan, which actually situates fiscal policy at the center of influencing the pace at which the country is expected to grow and its capacity to deal with key challenges that the plan identifies. Now, we look at the main economic episodes in the past and also projects going forward, how those episodes are likely to pan out. We find striking essentially from our analysis is the resistance in a way of the economy to break out of what was induced by the global economic crisis. As the acting chairperson was emphasizing, the economy is finding it extremely difficult to break out of the globally induced recession, despite us being now 6 years after the crisis, 6 years post the global economic crisis, but we are still far away from what can be considered the natural trend of the South African economic growth. And what we currently find and likely to characterize us, at least for the next 3 years, is the country being trapped in a vicious cycle of moderate to low growth, high inequality, and record high unemployment. So it's just a triple mix-up of bad outcomes that we are seeing over the short to medium horizon that really needs us grappling with the issue. Now, the sluggish economic growth has got a direct implication for our revenues, expenditures, and deficits, which is the link to the fiscal framework. The counter-cyclical stance that government has adopted and is pretty much still on. And when I talk about counter-cyclical stance, let's demystify it here. What this means is essentially that when your economy is not doing well, you respond by expanding your government expenditure. And when your economy is doing well, you do the opposite. You reduce your expenditure. So whenever I say counter-cyclical stance, let's simplify it. It's nothing complicated. It means in terms of your growth of expenditure, you're doing the opposite of what the economy is doing. If the economy is expanding, you are reducing expenditure growth of the government. If the economy is shrinking, you're increasing the expenditure part of your government growth. So whenever we talk
non-classical or any of those sentences, if I just mean that your spending cost is doing the opposite of what the economy is doing. That's why the culture. But now, because the economy has not been doing well, government has responded by increasing the cost and spending level to counteract that economic growth. Now the results of that, even without any analysis, is what we are seeing on the right-hand side graph there, which is essentially that the rectangles have started growing quite a lot. The rectangles are your private deficit that is started growing and are now consistently above around about the 3% level that we've been looking at. Now, in terms of poverty and inequality, as I said, although there's been some reduction in poverty since 1994, this has not been at the rate that was anticipated. In fact, inequality has remained doubly high, at one of the highest rates of around 0.67 when policy makers use a measure called Gini coefficient, which is a measure of how unequal a society is. So the three areas that our analysis from this chapter aims to as the focus areas for going forward is around issues surrounding investment in mid-level skills, because we can trace quite quickly the disjuncture between medium skill levels and inequality. The bottleneck or a gap, which is a big missing point when you transform from a school going age to working age. So it's that skill level component, which is an area of focus in the next 3 years. There are also issues around building adequate infrastructure, particularly in transport and energy, which constitute a huge bottleneck for the resuscitation economic growth rate at level expected. Then finally, they have the big challenges of how one distributes the fruit of economic growth more widely, because we are still talking about high levels of poverty and stubbornly high inequality. It means there are still issues of distribution that we are going to continue hearing over and over again in the next 3 years. And it's not issues that we can wish away, because they're going to be with us. There is some disjuncture on how we distribute that those fruits of economic growth. Even with low levels of economic growth, this distribution is still unequal. With high levels of economic growth before 2008, this distribution was still unequal. So we have issues that need discussing a lot with whatever the level of economic growth for South Africa. So those are the three key big ideas for the 3 year cycle around skills, around physical infrastructure, and around the distribution of economic growth. Now, coming back to the issue of physical sustainability, the issue that we have fixed on for the next year's division of revenue is characterizing the fiscal framework is really around issues of challenges caused by the public debt and need for fiscal
And what the chapter does is to look at the evolution of public debt and its impact on the rest of the economy, and see how the risks associated with rising domestic debt can be mitigated. And now, the main issue to take from this chapter is essentially that when you look at a 20-year span, the level of public debt is not very high. In fact, it's lower than around the aftermath of 1997, 1998 to 2000, following the so-called Asian crisis. So, but what is a big issue is that the trajectory or the direction that it has taken is unprecedented, at least in the past 10 to 15 years. We haven't seen it grow by as much as we've seen it grow in the last 3 to 4 years. So the issue of concern is not with the absolute level of public debt per se right now, but it's with the direction that it has taken that needs to be arrested. And we think it's very important to make that distinction between the direction of public debt as opposed to the actual level of public debt. Now, in terms of the recommendations we make around this chapter, the first one is that we seriously caution against avoiding setting or target for the size of public debt, especially at the level that we are at. In other words, borrowing is still a valid and appropriate option for national development. But the issue, as the chairperson pointed out, is extremely good debt management, where ideally you want to be borrowing for purposes of infrastructure as opposed to purposes of production. So we shouldn't be having discussions really around the appropriate level of public debt in this case, because we are very far away from what the literature actually comes up as optimal level of public debt. But that does not negate the direction that it is taking. Now, the second recommendation is that it should also not simply be about cutting costs in order to reduce the cost of public debt. Instead, we think government should take this as an opportunity to reform programs and service delivery. In other words, simple cost cutting as a driver of fiscal policy should not be the aim, but rather to aim towards doing less of what is not working and doing more of what is working. And that recommendation becomes extremely important when we come to balancing this fiscal problem with social impact, because it really speaks to the issue of generating more value for money for the existing resource envelope. So that's why the third recommendation they say we should avoid across the board cuts or expenditure ceilings, because those type of approaches essentially cheat some valuable, efficiently run programs, and those which are outdated and not performing at the same type program, and all are subjected to haircut or blanket expenditure cuts. So spending has to be aligned with government priorities, and adequate funding of high priority areas needs to continue to be the main initiative of fiscal policy, and elimination or substantial reduction of a lower priority programs. Now coming to coming to the third chapter, it continues with a discussion that we have been having for the last two submissions around social programs and need for fiscal reform. And the reason why we focus on this particular chapter is because we feel that according to the popular discourse that one finds, there could be an opportunity that the country can meet. The long and short of this particular chapter is that when there are discussions around fiscal reform, the area which popular discussion targets is in fact the wrong one, according to some. The problem is essentially not around the social problem that the country is pursuing. In fact, those are some of the areas of highest impact in terms of poverty reduction and majority inequality. So rather, the discussion should be somewhere away from the existing social programs. And in fact, policymakers should be celebrating one of the biggest achievements of the last 20 years, which was setting up the existing social programs, rather than thinking about doing away with it or making major adjustments to something that is not working. The problem is not in the social program area, but in other programs out of the social program. So the main point to take from chapter 3 based on its findings is that from a macroeconomic perspective and a fiscal sustainability perspective, where you hear most of the attack on social programs coming, there is no evidence using the 2011 census that we found in our modeling processes to track how the economy is going to be running and taking into account people eligible for the different programs. Secondly, in the next 15 to 20 years, there are no fears or issues of sustainability that should be used to argue against the social program. Instead, the argument or the tone of the argument of the discussion should be more around how you enhance the effectiveness of the social program. And the way that discussion should go should essentially not be around further tightening of conditions. Because when you look at issues of access to basic education, etc., those access rates are extremely high, which suggests to you that people that ought to be in school anyway are in school. So if you put better conditions or say the child support grant, they're not going to yield much excess higher administrative burden for yourself without much impact. Precisely because access rates are already high enough. So rather direct your effort where there are chances of making a huge impact. So that's essentially the big message coming out of the rest of the analysis from this chapter, that as we are way back in 2009, that when you are consolidating, don't consolidate at the expense of the social program. Here we're coming to see the more up-to-date evidence based on latest census information, again continually proving that this is not the behavior to be focusing our attention on as we let future fiscal policy for the country. So we do make three recommendations that are essentially talking to consolidating the benefit system and making it more friendly to users, and tightening on areas of fraudulent behavior, which don't talk to the system but to human actions where people don't enforce certain cause or requirements in the system that needs to be enforced around the eligibility criteria, but those are human behavior issues that needs to be stemmed out for good management systems rather than doing away completely with the program. Now coming to part two, is zeroing in on three of the core social impact areas around basic education, around primary health care, and around issues of food security. Starting with chapter four. Chapter four for this year looks at equitable resourcing of schools for better outcomes and evaluates the process of resource distribution and the effect that distribution has on the outcomes, given that they now this emphasis on performance and quality outcomes. Three key findings are that the chapter confirms variations and disparities in the allocation of the resources and performance of schools, the general perception of inadequate funding for field curricular requirements is also confirmed, and the association between resources and outcomes, particularly in poor schools. So the message, key message from the chapter here again is when you target your efforts around basic education, the inequalities that we started when framing the picture for the next 3 years also persist even with the school system. That in fact, if you want a big impact on your oversight intervention, most of that biggest impact is going to be by focusing on the poorest of the poor schools. Some of the schools probably don't need much of oversight intervention because they are in some way or another can take care of themselves. But the biggest impact for oversight or making substantial changes to the system is that focus on the tail end of the schooling system, particularly the poor of the poor schools. That's where you are going to make big dent onto the system. And the recommendation essentially speaks to that issue on how to be targeting the poorest of the poor schools, again, all in the interest of reducing the general inequality among the outcomes in the basic schools. Now, chapter 5 on adequacy and efficiency in primary health care looks at adequacy of the public health care funding. And just some backdrop into how this issue came to be a key issue for this submission. When the then Minister of Finance, Minister President Gordon, visited us at our annual general meeting in 2012, he requested the Commission to look into whether public health care is actually funded. And he wanted our opinion on those issues. Now, what we find in this chapter after carrying out the assessment, including extended budget analysis of public health care, is that despite the increase in growth in health spending, the sector is still facing huge problems in quality of care, inefficiencies in the system, and the heavy burden of disease, cost pressures from the input side, rising numbers of people that are uninsured, and again, inequities in distribution of resources
across the system. And those are the key drivers of the perception that the sector is underfunded. And the chapter makes it very clear that if these issues are not addressed soon, then they pose the most significant threat to any successful implementation of the national health insurance. So those things stick to the basis and to the core of what should be the underlying of the national health insurance system. Now, in terms of the recommendation, two major recommendations that the chapter looks at. The first speaks to provincial government, and it calls on the provincial health department to increase their allocation levels of primary health care funding so that it is in line with the minimum norms and standards for the primary health care package that the National Department of Health sets. When we look into those budgets, what is being allocated is actually below the norms and standards that the National Department set up. The second recommendation is meant to aid oversight on the health system. And here we find that inefficiencies of wasteful and irregular expenditure in the sector needs to be minimized. And for one to get a sense of where minimization can take place, we think the reporting of wasteful expenditure needs to be identified and reported on using three categories that allow you to get the action that you can take. The first is to characterize it into whether it is clinical waste, whether it is operational waste, or behavioral waste. And we think those three categorizations of distinguishing waste taking place in the health system will be important for an oversight committee when carrying out an oversight on the health department and within facility that we have a sense of exactly where are the large chunk of the area, including clinical waste, is it operational waste or behavioral waste. Chapter 6, which is on the impact of fiscal expenditure on food security, is a relatively new area that we're looking into, and again, the motivation being that you can do as much as you want on education spending and health spending, but if the households are food insecure, then you're not going to get the outcome that you deserve from the spending that you have made in those particular areas. We'll look quite closely into the food security. And another motivation is that since the global economic crisis, we have reason to suspect that the purchasing power of households has been hit hard by the sudden increases in electricity, fuel, and food inflation. So that has fueled that inflation. Thereby, they have threatened food security. We also see a lot of coordination problems that exist, partly contributing towards the underperformance of the agriculture conditional grant, so that we work with and we think that there are also important areas to focus on how those conditional grants are performing. There are a lot of coordination problems that our supply chain analysis has picked up. Now, in terms of the recommendation, five of them, but I will just stick to the essence of those recommendations. The first is to ensure that the National Department on Agriculture Fishery and Forestry
enforces the conditions in the grant framework to ensure better oversight of provinces. So that's the starting point. Those conditions which are in those conditional grants need a better enforcement from the central department. The second recommendation talks to a coordination of different programs that talk to food security, from agriculture itself, expanded public health program, school nutrition program, etc. So there is need to focus on improving the operation of those different food security programs so that they yield the amount of resources that are being thrown into those programs. The third area comes to the core of food security problems. And here is essentially clarifying the legislative mandate and responsibility of municipalities in relation to food security. Currently, it's very unclear what the role municipalities play legislatively in the area of food security. And in this regard, we think that DAP should develop a policy on food security with concrete proposals on how that mandate will be funded. Currently, municipalities don't see food security as their main area of competence. And as a result, it always goes unfunded at municipal level. Now, moving to part three, investment in municipal infrastructure. Definition here, I'll ask our colleague Alex to walk us through.
Okay, good morning, Chair and Honourable members. The first chapter in Part 3 looks at improving the financing of municipal capital investments. Now, in 2011 and 2012, the Financial and Fiscal Commission hosted public hearings on the nature of the challenges confronting the local government fiscal framework. Now, what these hearings confirmed is that there is an existence of vertical as well as horizontal capital funding gap. Now, at the local government level, capital infrastructure is largely funded through conditional grants. In terms of old revenue, funding is actually constrained. Now, this chapter looks at what are the factors that actually impact on the contribution of old revenue to municipal capital funding. Now, our findings and recommendations are as follows. What we found in terms of our findings is that there's a definite trend of underspending on municipal capital budgets between 2003 and 2010. And poor spending is largely a result of poor planning, which is largely due to a lack of planners as well as engineers in municipalities. We therefore recommend that in terms of Section 154 of the Constitution, where national and provincial government need to provide support and bulk assistance to municipalities, that monitoring and evaluation of municipal capital planning and spending needs to be improved, and that national and provincial treasury should improve risk assessment through the municipal benchmarking exercises which they regularly have with municipalities. And these benchmarking exercises need to look at three important areas. The one is to ensure that capital budgets are realistic and are financed. There needs to be greater emphasis on refurbishing and renewing existing infrastructure stock. And that there needs to be, the tariffs needs to be appropriately designed so that the restoration costs of existing infrastructure funding of new infrastructure are recovered from the actual tariffs. So it's really saying that we need to make sure that the tariffs that we charge are actually aligned what the actual costs are that relate to them, to the services. Our second finding in this research was that due to poor economic climate, municipal own revenue sources are actually under stress. And what we see is that municipalities have limited ability to generate surpluses from user charges for reinvestment in capital expenditure. We therefore recommend that municipalities should introduce alternative and innovative methods to fund and deliver infrastructure if capacity to plan and spend remain a concern. What we also found in our findings was that there is very limited data available for collected by National Treasury's PPP unit on existing PPP arrangements, and we therefore recommend that the PPP unit within National Treasury improves its monitoring and evaluation of municipal PPPs. And then finally, whereas other municipalities have some scope to borrow or use non-traditional revenue sources, such as PPPs, but when it comes to smaller rural municipalities, options are limited. We therefore recommend that government explores new funding and infrastructure delivery models for poorly resourced and rural municipalities. And here we say that there should be a greater role for state-owned companies as well as other state agents to deliver infrastructure on behalf of these municipalities. So we're really just saying that we need to look at a differentiated model for municipalities in terms of delivering infrastructure within the local governments here. The next chapter looks at improving public transport for better mobility. Now, the starting point for this research is that there is a critical gap between what policy says on the one side and what is actually happening on the ground in terms of the transport subsidy framework as well as implementation. And what this chapter looks at is to review the current public transport subsidy system and with the view of recommending an appropriate subsidy system that will actually align with the existing policy. Now, currently what we find within the transport sector is that a large proportion of households do not have access to public transport, or those that do have access to public transport are dissatisfied with the quality of public transport. There's also a situation where we have different modes of transport, but they are implemented in a disaggregated and a fragmented way, which means that we are unable to achieve economies of scale as well as achieve a seamless integrated transport system in our country. Now, in order for us to be able to address, on the one hand, the backlogs that we have in terms of households and individuals having access to public transport, and at the same time, to improve the quality of public services, what we do find is that previous experiences also in other countries show that one way of addressing this is to have focused interventions and appropriate consolidation of functions. Now, in terms of the National Land Transport Act, as well as previous research that the EFC has conducted, one of the ways of doing this is actually to assign transport functions to municipalities. Now, with regard to transport functions at the local government sphere, the National Land Transport Act is very clear in terms of what lands municipalities need to prepare. And at the local government sphere, integrated transport plans needs to be developed by all municipalities. And these integrated transport plans needs to show how municipalities are actually going to implement integrated transport within their respective jurisdictions. Now, what we find is that many of these integrated transport plans are either non-existent, or if they are existent, in many cases they are outdated. There's also no auditable targets within these integrated transport plans. So we basically made four recommendations with regard to this study. The one is that the integrated transport plans of municipalities need to show how municipalities intend to exercise network control within their jurisdictions. Also, very importantly, in terms of the current subsidy framework, what we have recommended is that the current subsidy framework should be reviewed to take into consideration the three important factors of policy highlight. Number one, social welfare. In other words, how do we cater for poor households in our subsidy formula? Productivity. In other words, how can we actually increase the services to households? And then thirdly, environmental management, which basically looks at how do we actually reduce emissions, carbon emissions, and also increase the use of public transport relative to private transport. Also, very importantly for municipalities to play their role in terms of implementing integrated transport functions, there's a need for municipalities to develop critical skills so that they're able to implement these complex systems. And we therefore recommend that Department of Transport and Shelter basically look at what are the minimum set of skills required for municipalities to implement these transport functions. And finally, given the poor quality of our integrated transport plan, we call on the Department of Transport and Shelter to have a comprehensive review of useful integrated transport plans so that with the view of identifying the gaps and what needs to be addressed in terms of improving those transport plans. Now, moving on to the next chapter, which looks at the impact of electricity prices decreases on municipalities. This chapter looks at the issue of administered prices. And administered prices are in various sectors, including energy, transport, water, as well as telecommunications. Now, electricity tariff increases affect not only end users, but also municipalities as well. The biggest cost for municipalities in terms of the distribution of electricity is the buying of electricity, buying of bulk electricity from Eskom. And the purchases or the cost of this electricity is regulated by NERSA. So NERSA regulates the cost that municipalities purchase the electricity from Eskom, but NERSA also regulates the increase or the retail price that municipalities can charge in terms of selling the electricity to end users. Now, what our study found was that the increase in bulk electricity costs had a statistically negative impact on municipal revenue and expenditure. So what this implies is that when the cost of buying electricity from Eskom increases, it crowds out spending on other items. And importantly, from a revenue perspective, when the cost of buying electricity goes up, you basically have these limitations to the extent to which you can increase tariffs to end users. That negatively impacts on the revenue of the municipality. This is key because revenue earned through electricity distribution should be used in terms of reinvesting within the sector and also the cross-subsidization of poor households as well. So in this regard, what we have recommended is that there should be a plan in place to manage the risks to municipality associated with the increase in the price of bulk electricity purchases. And this should look at the implications of the increase in the price of bulk electricity purchases on municipal revenue as well as expenditure. And this should look at the differential impact on different municipalities as well as some of the important developments that are currently taking place, such as your carbon tax, which may have implications in terms of the cost of bulk electricity purchases. We know that quite often when these regulatory reforms do take place, the cost of enforcement is passed on to end users, either directly or via the municipality. And then finally, the last chapter in this section looks at human settlements, the demand, housing demand, which is critical in providing for future housing needs. A secondary focus of this chapter also looks at what are some of the key constraints and levers for self-built housing. Now, the reason for this is that if we can focus and encourage households that are able to contribute to their own housing needs, to participate in self-built options, this will free up much needed resources for the most vulnerable groups. Now, in this regard, we've basically made three recommendations in terms of the analysis of our study. The first recommendation is that municipalities, especially your metros, should invest in forward-looking processes and systems that will enable municipalities to accurately understand and also disaggregate housing demand. And metros should focus on planning for rental flats and creating new neighborhoods in intermediate towns which have lower densities than inner cities. Also, very importantly for this study was being able to distinguish between those poor households that are able to use the self-built option and those households that would need subsidy housing free of charge. Now, what our study found was that self-built initiatives, households that would be most eligible for self-built initiatives would be those with a housing replacement cost between 2,500 Rand and 8,000 Rand. Between 8,000 Rand and 20,000 Rand. Households with a housing replacement value below 2,500 Rand would require subsidy housing from government. And these are households that are generally vulnerable groups, such as your female-headed households as well as your children under the age of 20. We therefore recommend that housing subsidy prioritizes these groups, but should also look at targets and indicators that should be put in place and closely monitored, as well as the Department of Human Settlements should report on housing benefits of government housing programs based on gender, as well as by age on a yearly basis. Now, what our study also found was that there are key levers for self-built initiatives, such as land registration, as well as provision of basic infrastructure services. We therefore recommend that municipalities should prioritize land ownership registration processes where informal settlements are located in developable areas, and then government should prioritize the provision of infrastructure areas where potential for self-built housing is possible. That is the end of the recommendations for the master.
Thank you, Khalid. I think the last part of this presentation basically speaks to an issue that the Commission considers to be quite critical in thinking about division of revenue 2015, especially going to the local government elections in 2016. What came up during the course of the year was a matter that basically carried over from the last demarcation process that happened before the last local government election, which saw the city of Tshwane being amalgamated with a few of the municipalities surrounding it, which basically resulted in it being one of the biggest metros around. And the result of that demarcation process was that the city of Tshwane had to deal with a massive negative financial implications that were directly resulted from the amalgamation, which partly based on the liabilities of the other municipalities that had to be amalgamated with it. So the Commission did receive a letter from the city of Tshwane, which indicated the amounts that were involved. And in the process of doing that, we were also engaged in discussions with the Municipal Demarcation Board, which was busy looking at redemarcations in the run-up to the 2016 elections. And we then decided to look at the city of Tshwane's case and also look at the past demarcations, what the implications were. And the unfortunate part of the result is that most, if not all, of the cases that we looked at basically indicated that there were quite negative implications for the financial viability of the municipalities that have been relocated, and that became quite an issue for the commission. And so we have made here some recommendations that relate to how we can actually mitigate this issue. It is very clear that when demarcation of municipal boundaries or redetermination is done, it's not always necessarily about the financial issues. It's about service delivery, it's about scale economies. There's a lot of issues that are involved. But from the Commission's perspective, it is important that when we actually do that, we have to understand that the decisions that will have been taken are beyond the control of the municipalities themselves. And so municipalities generally, because of the results that we have found when we looked at this, generally they find themselves in an enviable position, as it were, of financial challenges relating to the viability. So we engaged with the demarcation boards, and we then came up with some recommendations. And the recommendation basically is that we need a transitional conditional grant. The operative word is transitional. It cannot be a grant that is institutionalized for the municipalities that have been demarcated. It cannot be simply handed over. There has to be a thorough exercise, basically looking at what the financial liabilities are, because what we discovered is that when the demarcation board does this thing, those are not issues that were prioritized in the process of making the final determination. So upfront, we require that this kind of an exercise be conducted, and where there will be negative financial implications, a conditional grant put in place, which is to assist the municipality to deal with whatever shocks are actually accompanied by this demarcation process. And it should be a year before and a year after. We are aware that there's a couple of redeterminations or demarcations that have taken place, although one of them, we were just made aware that there is some court processes around that, which is unfulfilled. But these are real issues that we have to be confronting going into 2015 in preparation for those demarcations, so that those municipalities do not find themselves in financially unviable situations. So the recommendation is basically that a conditional grant be put in place. I am aware that we have received from SAGA in terms of this request for assistance in how that grant can actually be designed, and the team that we have assigned to the process with SAGA to assist from a technical point of view on the design of this particular grant. We do think that it's an important it should be an important part of the 2015 program. That is the end of the presentation, Chairperson, and thank you very much, members.
Thank you very much to Chairperson and the Chief from the FSC, the National Treasury team is also here, the budget office. Welcome to all of you. Now, honorable members will agree that this is a lot of work that has been done by the FSC, and one to assume that the submission has already also gone to National Treasury and other stakeholders. It is our opportunity to understand it, discuss it, but I'm sure that we will not exhaust it in one day. perhaps what we can do, there may be issues of clarity that members might want to ask throughout all the various chapters. And once they are much clearer, they can also make comments on the substance of the recommendation to understand exactly the issues that are been raised by the FSC for the 2015-16 looking at the division of revenue. The theme there is balancing fiscal sustainability with socio-economic impact. That appear that in the next 3 years there's going to be a lot of the balancing acts. Where we are now with the low growth projections going forward, high levels of unemployment, growing debt, demands are increasing for social services, how do we balance all these things going forward? So I think the overriding theme, and maybe we can allow members to engage with it. Because when we discuss the division of revenue next year, even with the medium-term budget policy statement in October, these are the issues that we can take into account in engaging with that medium-term budget policy statement and again with the division of revenue next year. So I suggest, honourable member, that perhaps you may want to just quickly go through the various chapters to have clarity, then again right up to the end, and then we'll allow members to go and read a little more, and we may ask you to come again to the committee field that they want to engage. I'm sure that will be important. Okay, thank you very much. So let me allow honorable members, if there's a chapter or there's part one, part one is macroeconomic fiscal framework for inclusive growth. Maybe we might start with that one. Let me say to members, either comments or clarity factors on the issues. We'll start with the macro economic and fiscal framework for inclusive growth, where they are looking at macroeconomic perspectives, and then there are recommendations at the end of that. Macroeconomic perspectives goes up to the contributing macro, then there's issues of public debt. So if we just go like that, I think we'll have a much more structured discussion if the committee agrees. Is that the proper way to do it? Okay. Who wants to come first? Honorable Fink, you want to come first?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Honorable Fink, this commission, our member, we take into consideration what you said about this comment, because obviously it is a lengthy document, so in order to absorb it, one needs to read it. So there are just, if I just refer to slide 7, 10, and 11, if you'll allow me. community, and I just use my opportunity to speak now. Slide 7 is on page 4. And that's the one that deals with the debt to GDP ratio now. That is obviously a serious concern, and I know at a previous presentation, I can't recall who was it, if it was the National Treasury, but I don't want to point fingers. We indicated that that is not a serious concern because the debt GDP ratio was at 23% in 2008, and currently it's gone right up to 40%, and there was some sort of a promise that it's going to stop somewhere around there. Now, that's been positive, and I believe you all should be positive, but for me, that's a serious concern is that it's increasing at a very rapid rate. So that is one of the concerns. Because if we look at slide number 11, and that's why I wanted to take it together, which is on page 6, and the CEO of the SSC indicated that governments should avoid setting targets for the size of public debt, as well as avoiding across the board cuts for expenditure ceilings. Now, again, obviously that's the reason why we're sitting at about 40%, because of that approach that is being used. And for me, I believe that is something serious by doing that. And then also in line with the policy of social development, or what do we say here, balancing social economic impact. So while looking after the country does not cost, it's not cheap in our country. So my concern is that we seriously need to look at how and where the money is going to come from, because by borrowing is becoming more expensive, because in one of the other slides, and that is why I want to talk about slide 10 as well, it is mentioned there that the interest payments are at the lowest level in 20 years. So it's at the lowest level now, and there's only one way that it can go, and that is up. So, you know, it's going to put the country in serious problems if we use those policies of not setting targets or not worrying about the size of public debt and so forth. So those are concerns to me, the chairperson, is that, you know, and obviously, one of the ways of not cutting expenditure is then not to go to the taxpayer and ask him for more. One option is borrowing, which is going to get us into serious debt, but the other option is to go to the taxpayer and ask him for increasing tax, and obviously that is not going to go down well. So those are just, for now, concerns that I would have with Honourable Chairperson.
Your view is that we should be worried about the growth in the debt level. And then maybe when the FSB respond, they can also deal with the issue of is our debt level out of control to the cops? Because I think that might be also a very important point to deal with what they are raising, where they are saying, look, you can still borrow for building assets to the future for telling the economy. So I think that's a good question. It's almost like, don't worry about the debt. You've got work to do, you have to grow the economy, you have priorities, fund them. Then kind of that's spirit that may be wrong. But if they fund them, don't worry about setting targets. So if you have priorities in the country, you have to grow the economy, if you push your debt level to 3 trillion, do it. that's the way to go. But I think they will respond, because I'm also, my question was going to be, is our debt level out of control as a country? And maybe that question might also allow us to discuss the issue of whether there is a need to set the limits and say, here and no more. Whether you have priorities or what, we're not going to go. We live with what we have, we cut spending, reprioritize, don't do things that we thought we would do, etc. But I think that's for me, that's a very important thing that I think we should have that discussion. Honorable McClellan, you went next, and then Honorable Kabaja, Honorable Manopa, you thought.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Yes, I just want to concur with Honorable Fick in disagreeing with the Deputy Chairperson that the debt level is not really to be worried about at this stage. We're in a situation where our economy is suffering. It is not performing well. So there's ever-increasing pressure on us to borrow more money. Our credit rating keeps being brought down, so the cost of that borrowing is going up. As I said in my speech in Parliament, you can't borrow your way out of debt. It's unsustainable and you're going to get yourself into trouble. It's all very well to say, well, let's exchange having a nice asset for the debt we've got. It's like this, buy a Rolls Royce and over 2 million rand. But to what end? We need to have a plan to get out of this debt. We've already got this huge amount of debt that we're servicing, and we need to know that there's a road ahead. Not just, well, let's just keep borrowing. It doesn't matter. We've got things to do. We need to borrow. We don't know what our economy is going to be doing in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time. And I guess part of the thinking here is, well, it's not going to be our problem. The next administration is going to have to worry about how we pay this back. But I don't think that's a sensible way of looking at it. We have to think in terms of generalization and the generations to come. How are they going to receive this from us and say, well, we did a good job or we did a bad job? If all they get from us is a load of debt, well, I know how I would have felt if my father died and left me with a load of debt to pay on his behalf. It doesn't work. We need to find a plan and get a way of getting ourselves out of this cycle. If the Honourable Chairperson will allow me, I'll just extend my comments a bit further and say, in general, when I look at this, it seems that we're focusing on small areas rather than looking at the big picture. If I just think about the approach to public transport, for example, now we're saying we're going to shift it down to the municipalities. Let's make it the municipalities department. We've got a department of transport, but let's let them off the hook and give it to the municipalities. After all, they only get 9% of the national budget, so let them worry about the little bit of money we give them. They must find the answer. We can't sustain this. If we're going to expect municipalities to do more and more and assume more and more of the burden, which we're doing throughout sharing the census, the infrastructure, the provision of water and services, everything else, we want them to do more. We want them to come up with better plans, but we're not giving them the money to do it. At the same time, we have the NSMA and the state of municipalities, well, you must collect the money that's due to you. But if they can't do it, what do they do? You cited Mfuleni, Deputy Chairperson. Mfuleni has got a huge debt owed to it, that it cannot ever recover. We know that. It's going to get written off. So who carries the cost, ultimately? The municipality can't cover it. And in the meantime, service suffers, because that's why we have demonstrations and people unhappy, because they're not getting the services. We have to address that somehow. We have to accommodate that need, that gap in their funding. And we have to do it out of the national system. There's nowhere else for it to come from. Unless there's a whole policy turned around and we start saying, well, at whatever cost, you're going to collect that debt. But then we'll have half the country out rioting because their houses have been repossessed and their cars have been sold and whatever else. We need to find a way to address the situation. So, thank you, Chair.
So, an important point, can we get out of the debt? Is there a plan? Can there be a plan? What is that plan? nutrition and training system, or is it really a disconnect between education and training and the players in the economy who must tell us what skills the people require, and therefore enable education and training to produce the skills that the economy requires? I raise this question because I'm beginning to doubt whether we are really short of money. We're not investing enough in education and training. Probably in resourcing basic education, that there might be a problem not so much education money, I don't know. But so far as FET, universities and so on and so on, I'm not convinced that we are not investing enough. But you could, if you could explain that. I raise this issue because if we don't connect these two, brother and sister, education and training and the players in the economy, we might continue to say we need more investment in food production when in fact there is investment, but we are not using it correctly. There was an article in I think it was in February, which says that some 365 expatriates take back into the country around November, December, and by January, February, all of them were gone, which tells you that they are jobs. The challenge may be that inside the country we are not producing. Another report speaks to this very important subject of training entrepreneurs, so that we then input into our small medium enterprises and cooperatives. Most of our universities have schools of business and administration or something like that. But we don't seem to be knocking it at the level of producing managerial skills, business skills, and so on and so on. In fact, there is a report which says there is a shortage of business schools in any case in the African continent generally. But South Africa seems to be hitting the head, but we are not seeming to be effective. So what is it? Is it investing in these skills? Is it this disconnect that I'm talking about at various levels? So that we begin to refocus ourselves and you talked about focusing on priorities and finding those priorities and cutting down on areas which we think are not of serious priority. Thank you.
Yes,
No, thanks for the presentation. Thanks for the presentation. It looks like, you know, a lot of information really that is assisting us when we deal with the different departments and see whether what we really the spending from is really keeping us paid for money. Okay, on the issue of the debt, like on facing a government target on the debt, can you really unpack for us? What do you mean to say that it's not, they should avoid setting targets for size of public debt? Maybe to unpack so that we really understand what is the meaning. And also you indicated that the challenge is not the debt per se, but the challenge is or can be the direction it is taking. So if you can tell us, because it goes back to what the chair is saying, to say that the challenge that we are having in the sector is still within the acceptable manner that we can continue. And we can also check, because to me, if it's going like from 23% to 40%, really, as you indicated in your presentation, that you know, the speed that it is going, really, if it is not controlled, it can lead to a challenge, more challenge than we anticipate now. Maybe you can share with us what is the acceptable norm of borrowing, if we can understand this one, because to us, if the economy is not growing, is there any way that we can control this debt now? Because it's really not growing the way we are looking at it. Although we don't want to say that we are in a recession, but you know, there are red lines, you know, going there to say that we are. What is the way that we can use to control it if now it is an acceptable norm that is accepted, that is required? You also indicated on your slide to say that on your recommendation, we must reduce the fraud and corruption and administrative costs, because also it is a burden that will lead to us borrowing more, you know. But you talk about borrowing not for consumption, but to invent such a thing. But I want to check, maybe, although it's not here, there has been a call by the president and the government to say that you have to reduce the usage of consultants, because sometimes it leads to duplication. You employ a person, you put there the competencies that you want, but now those competencies, you employ a person and then now take a consultant. It's not a technical thing that you cannot do. It's a duplication. Maybe if you can share with us whether are we reducing the usage of consultants, and also are we really checking where are we going to use the consultants? Maybe to have a guide to say that the consultants will only be used on a technical thing, but not on something that when you employ a person was part of the competencies that was required in a department, because maybe it will assist us to reduce the spending on consumption and so on and so forth, as you have indicated. And also to check whether those particular consultants that are being used, are they really transferring skills? If now they are used for technical methods, are they really, when they leave, can we be certain and be sure that no, now there will still be to transfer, so that the department can continue working without continuously using the consultants? And also you talk on the issue of the local government. The local government, you indicated or you made a recommendation to say that maybe in the local government, the local government, the lack of planning in the local government, which leads to the lack of spending of the capital budget. I don't know what changed, but it's something of the sort. I think it's 15, yeah. The lack of spending of the local government. But at the same time also, you are recommending that we have to increase, you know, to increase the funding in infrastructure delivery models for poorly resourced and rural municipalities, while at the same time they are failing to spend the current capital budget that they have. And I don't know whether the intervention by the other spheres of government, as you indicated, like Section 164 of the Constitution, the support of the local government sphere, to say that which comes first, because will be giving money to the people that are failing to spend money. We said those particular municipalities have got the challenge of the streets. They are not safe. They are failing to plan. They don't have capacity and so on. I don't know whether maybe we can have a recommendation that is saying like the provincial and national government to really intervene and really give the necessary skills, you know, while we are busy with preparing to raise more funds for them to spend in the infrastructure. Thank you.
The last thing is really a conceptual question. How
are we going to fight growth going into the future? Because it's rather good to say we are looking at 3 bad years, low levels of growth, high unemployment, inequality increasing. But we know that growth does not grow through players. It's clear. Isn't that the case? Don't conscious plan for growth and say, in the next 10 years, we want to push our level of growth to 5%, and then we come up with a plan. But it seems the narrative in South Africa is that, look, things are bad. The next 3 years, no growth, we are bad. I don't hear that we have plans to deal with that. Even if it is good borrowing. And maybe it's something that we really need to be, because I don't think growth is going to come when it wants to come. It's actually plan. Yes, there are some externalities that we may not have control of. But what about the domestic economy? Are there plans that we can put in place that can turn the situation around in the next 5-10 years? We can't limit it necessarily to NGOs. We can even, we're looking at the period of the NDT. But I think if we continue to go forward and say, well, this is not bad, and there is no sense that we are safe, and I think maybe that's what the Honorable Mekin was saying, let's plan to ensure that we turn things around. And it might not necessarily be you can't borrow. You may be able to borrow to give you that plan. But I thought maybe something that we should continue to discuss going forward, the issue of growth. Is our fiscal framework designed to protect growth? Big question. Is designed to do that? It's well and good to say, well, projections are done to come out this year 2%, next year maybe 2%, but don't we want to? So then if we want it, what are we doing to plan for it? It's like we're giving up before we even try. But the economy is going to grow back 2%, so there's nothing we can do. It's bad. Reprioritize. I don't think how to work like that. National Treasury is here, but no, it's the airplane. They're going to come and complain to their citizens. The matter is so bad. Tighten the belt, that's it. Where is there a light at the end of the tunnel? I don't think the light will just come. It's going to make us to put this together to say, maybe we need those ideas, whether it's investment in the municipalities, infrastructure so that can turn the economy around, start moving it towards growth. But let me leave it there, because I think the FFC, they know these issues. They will be able to tell us better what the challenges are. Over to you, sir.
Maybe just to make a comment on your last set of issues around how do we get out of this mode that says it's bad. So, you see, over a long period of time, when you look at the performance of the South African economy, you will see that there is certainly something wrong with the structure that needs to happen. The structure of the economy needs to change somehow. Now, if you look at the past, let's say the past 15 years, of very good economic growth, surpluses and all of that, you really get to see a situation that says policy has been about, let's manage our expenditure, let's manage our expenditure, let's manage our expenditure. So you get complacent. And when a crisis hits or when a shock hits, that basically requires the economy to respond. Because the economy will respond because of its resilience and its robustness. If it's not like that, it's not going to be able to respond. Some countries that have a similar type of base in terms of resources, naturally, otherwise, did not get the kind of a shock that South Africa got. If you look at a country like Australia, for example, during the global economic crisis, South Africa initially we thought, it's not going to be that bad. We are cushioned. But because the economy is not robust, it couldn't actually respond. And so taking advantage of a situation like that and turning it to advantage because the economy is resilient and robust is something that is lacking in the South African economy. So I think the discussion that you are raising with the last education is a very big discussion, and I think for some of us that were at the conference on Tuesday, the Deputy Minister of Finance in his address actually spoke in a very direct way to the need to actually start the shifting and changing the way we think about and the narrative, how we actually deal with this issue. We can't continue in the direction that we've been going. We need to actually look at where is the money going to come from. Now, let me go back to the first set of issues, and I'll just talk to a few, and then I'll ask Ramos to also come in and explain a little bit more. The issue, honorable members, at the back, honorable speakers, the issues that we are raising around the absolute size of debt not being a concern is that, in terms of the international norms, the international norm is that a debt to GDP ratio of about 60% thereabout is pretty much the norm that you can actually have. If you find yourself going beyond 60%, then you must get one. Now, internationally, if you look at the OECD countries, these are the countries, including also in group United States of America, they are hovering around 80-something, some of them 101. United Kingdom, I don't know whether they've managed to bring it down now, because at some stage they were 101%. The United States has always been up there. They feed on other people, basically. Now, you have these issues around debt. Now, for us, the concern at this point in time, and that must be made very clear, is exactly the concern that we're having. It's growing too fast. And if it's growing as fast as it has done in the past 4 years, what we must then start thinking about is what has driven it, and are we getting any value from that very fast rate of growth in debt? And so when I say don't worry too much about the ceilings, I'm saying can we just like focus a little bit more on what is actually driving this GDP ratio, because it's interest commitment, it's trading off somebody's future. It's postponing taxes, as you say, because even if we don't pay the taxes today, we go and borrow because it's easier to do that, the future generations will have to pay back that money. So when you borrow, you're postponing taxes. There's two sides of the same coin. And so the issue that we are more concerned with now is that if we are actually going to say, no, okay, what the Ramos told me, the static average, they are all higher than, it's all higher than South Africa. So we have managed, you know, for a very long time to actually keep it at very manageable level. But like I'm saying, our economy fails to respond to the global economic crisis because of the financial is outdated. It needed to change. So the issue is, I'm very much in agreement with you that we have to be concerned about. But I'm saying, where should the focus be? The focus should be, we've got very bad infrastructure in this country. We've got
high unemployment, we've decided now we're going to use counter-cyclical fiscal policies to actually try and pull the economy out. The private sector is not coming to the party. Now, the infrastructure is also the infrastructure program, which is aimed at resuscitating this economy and modernizing it. It's a very big problem. Now, are we spending the money that we are borrowing in that direction, which is what is going to be the heritage of our future generations? Now, if, as I say, if we are borrowing so that we can pay salaries, then there's a very big problem, and you have every right to say, I disagree with the Financial and Fiscal Commission on this particular matter. So I'm saying, because we're talking about next year, division of revenue, we're talking about the MTF, where should our focus be? Should our focus be to say, no, we can't go beyond 45% of debt to GDP? Probably not make a lot of. We must be able to control this growth. We must be able to decompose it and say it's growing, but it's actually driven by ABCD. These are things that are of value. I'm coming to that, whether we can actually bring it down. Bringing it down would probably be about, can we arrest the growth rate? Bringing it down is not something that you can do in the very short term. So can we arrest that growth rate? Now that now brings you to these issues around the expenditure ceiling. So you've got to say, if public spending is growing, public spending is growing at a rate. At some point it was growing at a very high rate. It's now been put down, I think now in real terms it's around about 2%, or from around about 8 to 10% over the past 3 or 4 years. Now if you bring it down to those levels, then on the, because you are not allowing any new programs that do not make sense. You are saying this is what is accord, this is all you can have. So if you want to introduce new programs, please go ahead but find the money somewhere else. So we're not putting any new money into these things. So you just like saying to yourself, if I have done this, because now I'm linking, you must be linking it to what revenue you are generating and what your borrowing requirements is going to be. So if you reduce your borrowing requirements through cutting down, slowing down growth on the expenditure side, you'll be able to reduce the rate of growth in your debt. So the idea here when we say avoid across the board cuts and savings, we are not saying do not cut on the expenditure side. We are saying there are certain programs that are assisting you and helping you to generate growth on the growth side. So like your education, all of those, they relate to your skill, they relate to your child support grants, all of those things. They keep people fed, they keep people going to work. So you can't just like cut those and impose things on them. You need to keep that balance going. But the biggest choices are what is of priority, because what you must prioritize is something that will contribute to your economic growth. So it's the choices that must be made, and that brings me to the question that you raised around the consultant. See, remember when you would recall that when the Minister of Finance last year tabled the story around cost containment measures, one of the points in those cost containment measures is that every accounting officer must produce a plan which says these are the consultants that I'm using and this is what I'm using for and this is the plan of how I am actually getting rid of these consultants. So every accounting officer is in terms of that section are supposed to have a plan on how these consultants will be reduced, because as you correctly say, there are people that work for government, fail to do the job, get out of government, start a consultancy company because they know the processes, they then come back and actually do the job and double or triple what
they were being paid when they were on the job. It happens, and we know. And the Auditor General knows, the Public Service Commission knows. So those, the numbers, I won't be able to tell you what that, those numbers are, but I think if you get the Public Service Commission or the AG, they'll be able to distill them and tell you exactly what the numbers are around it. It's quite a substantial amount of money that the state is losing. So the idea basically around this issue is that we need to be able to say the money that we have in the system, is it insufficient to deal with the challenges that we're facing? We certainly do not think so as the Financial and Fiscal Commission. We think if the money is utilized appropriately, allocated also efficiently, we should be able to do the basics that we're supposed to be doing from the fiscal side. Now, the problem is that we've got all of these inefficiencies that actually result in the losses or the wastage that we actually see. Now, the Auditor General, by the way, when they table those numbers, that's not the absolute. The numbers are actually quite big because those are like the samples that they would have looked at within the different departments when they do their audit. If you look at across the board and say, no, let's get into every program of every department, of every entity, it's massive amounts of money that actually sitting out there that needs to be revisited. So the complacency that we had because of the night times that we were living in, the days when the Minister of Finance would come with fruits and distribute fruits in Parliament when he tabled the budget, it generated its own a complacency and some of these things just touching. Let me just check. The other question that you asked, Jefferson, is a very direct one. Is the debt out of control? I don't think so, no. It's not out of control. What is of concern? What is out of control or of concern? I think let me ask Ramos to really provide some of the... We'll come back on the local government ones when you come to that section.
I think you want to come into this debate, but let's allow Ramos to come.
Yeah. This is a quite difficult question that honorable members here are posing. There are three ways to deal with debt problem, whether it's your own personal debt or national debt. You grow your income, you reduce your expenditures, or you grow revenue. Three. For fiscal policy, the main focus is on controlling expenditures and revenue. We'll come back to the economic growth angle that the Chairperson raised. And it actually turns out to be one of the most effective yet uncelebrated ways of dealing with the debt problem. Now, for expenditures and revenue, I think to avoid the problem running way out of our control, we need to look into the medium-term budget policy statement that's going to come, and last year's medium-term budget policy statement, because this is where the link comes in. The medium-term budget policy statement targeted that we would stabilize public debt going into 2016-17 on the assumption, key assumption that we made in our recommendation. We will meet the expenditure reduction, the expenditure cost reduction set in the medium term budget policy statement of last year and the revenue growth. What we have noticed is that revenue growth is now very large compared to the much relief from SARS and other revenues, and other agencies bringing in more revenues. So the revenue side is almost closed. At least the expenditure cost reduction policy. Our recommendation in the last MPBTS was that when you look at what government promises to do in terms of the outcome, we raise concerns about two not dying. And we use the analogy of someone always promising to go on diet, but never going on diet and postponing it when the time for going on diet comes about. So the main issue for this MCPTF is actually going to be around the promise in the last MCPTF and what the new MCPTF is saying, because that is right at the center of whether we're going to stabilize growth in the public sector. So I think if we structure the debate around MCPTF and what is new promise and what then we are likely to get a liberal and we will come to a credible answer on whether this is spiraling out of control or not. From last year's MGPS, there is actually no reason except concern that expenditure cost reduction is not as fast as what promised. That's the issue that we picked up as the one. For the new MCPTS, we don't know yet. Maybe there will be new issues to make us to fear that it may be spiraling out of control. But if what was promised last year is anything to go by for the new MCPTS, then coming to 2016-17, we should be on sustainable long-term debt. Then coming to the economic growth lever out of the expenditure and revenue, the cleanest and least painful way of reducing public debt is raising your economic growth rate. Right. So I say it's the cleanest and least painful because you don't have to make huge adjustments on reducing expenditures or revenue. It's the cleanest, but possibly the most difficult. Possibly the most difficult to actually get economic growth going. So where our reasoning ties quite nicely with what Jeff is proposing is when you look into our 2011 submission for the division of revenue. We made a recommendation that that went as follows. Government should explicitly target economic growth rate for the division of revenue process for 2013-14. Government's response was, we are already doing that. Right? So government's response was, we are already doing that. But what we actually had in mind was that this animal called economic growth is not as simple or even as just a copy that is a sense of. We had even far reaching thinking of targeting economic growth rate where one could even go as far as having a growth council that comes and reports to the health agencies around one terms of reference. Are the different departments, the different spheres of government contributing to economic growth by their actions? If so, by how much or how off the click are they? And unless if we have that sort of a council or a structure that's charged with just economic growth, then it will continue to be holding our hands or accepting whatever outcome. It really is. And I think now that recommendation has probably 1.4%. Economic growth per annum, and we're growing at 1.9%, round about 1.9% in the first 2 years of the plan, which means we've got a lot of work to do, which gives even more impetus to the point about actually targeting and doing something about economic growth through a clearly defined structure. What that structure is, we can leave that open for discussion. But as I said, it could even be a cross cancer, whichever way constitutes for the purpose of that. Then, your question about content for counter cyclical my assessment is that as long as it is understood that if counter cyclical stance has consequences, both positive and negative, and that those consequences need to be managed, then there's nothing per se wrong with the stance. Right. Let me backtrack. Counter cyclical stance is very easy to do when you are in crisis. Because, you, as I say, counter cyclical stance means to do the opposite of what the economy is doing. So when you're in a crisis, you respond by growing expenditure to counter the crisis. That's fairly easy to do because then you can justify even borrowing during that period. The difficult part is what to do during good times. During good times, it turns out that it's extremely difficult to moderate expenditures when people know that in the treasury the money is there. It's extremely difficult to implement counter-cyclical policy when the economy is in fact doing well, and I would say the job of national treasury is much tougher when the economy is doing well. And when we look at the 20-year horizon, we're there. Two phases. Up to 2008, you can think of that as a period where we were in a good times in terms of the economy doing well, and post 2008, the economy not doing so well. So it turns out that managing fiscal policy was much tougher when we're doing well. Why do we say that? Well, because we are almost running out of the buffer we built during the good times, which goes against counter cyclical stance. That we did not save, or we did not create sufficient enough buffer to withstand a crisis of this nation. So it leads you to two sorts of discussions. Is this crisis permanent or transitory? If you think it's permanent and that is going to be with us another 5-10 years, then it's time to structurally adjust your economy rather than continue worrying about stabilizing or playing around with counter-cyclical measures. We won't comment at this stage on duration of the crisis or whether it is transitory or. But those are the major questions. Is this a transitory crisis or is it now a permanent or long-term crisis? And that's where the answer to whether it should be on counter-cyclical stance versus full-scale adjustment really comes in and when you begin to question overall stance on macroeconomic policy. Then the other question on education and global government, we can come into that. To those, I think there were two honorable members who wanted to come in.
come back to this part quickly, Honorable Professor Karate Sikh. Then once they have commented, you will comment, then we'll take another round looking into the next set of issues. But as I said, we will not exhaust this today, but there are issues that we have raised about infrastructure, the expenditure on social aspects like education and health, for example, we'll take those comments. I would like to end the meeting at 1 to allow members to have lunch before they go to the speaking of the House.
Thank you, Chairperson, and for the opportunity. And before I talk to this, I just want to thank the FSC for the very informative conference. That actually sharpened my mind to think about what to do about this economy. I think it was very helpful. I remember when I passed on the stick and my mother thought I was growing up, and she set me down. She told me one thing that I don't forget. She said, my child, in any situation that does not work well for you in life, don't blame another person. Blame yourself. Because if you blame another person, there's nothing you're going to do about the situation. But if you blame yourself, at least you'll do something about it. So I've adopted that policy in my life. Anything that goes wrong with me, I blame nobody else, except myself. And I want to say, in this situation, I think the fact stops with Parliament. We have watched people fend, we have called people to account in a manner that I consider it were just conducting rituals. In this fifth Parliament, I think our situation calls upon us as committees of the legislature to do our work. The first president of the United States, the one said, people will not account unless they are made to account. We must make people account. I honestly believe, Chairperson, that we have got enough money in our pocket. There is enough to do what we want to do. But there is a lot of wastage as we speak. I think we, especially as this committee, we need to call people to account. We need to ask people to give us assurances of what they are going to do about the many consultants, as you said. We also need to make sure that heads of department actually sign contracts. We've been informed that some of them don't. We need to make sure that those things happen. In 1998, we legislated the Public Finance Management Act. As far as I'm concerned, that act is sufficient. It's sufficient to hold people to account. It's sufficient to protect the money of the state to do what the strategic plan wants them to do. Because you see, people come and show us their strategic plan. We go to the appropriation, we appropriate money in Parliament according to their plan. But down the line, people are no longer following those strategic plans. Mm-hmm. And it happens in front of our eyes. Mm-hmm. I was sleeping. I think this time, let's blame ourselves. We're not doing our work as members of Parliament. Because if we keep on lamenting as members of Parliament, what else? The other thing is that you see, South Africa has got a lot of, it's endowed with a lot of resources. We must industrialize. We must beneficiate. We can't just be taking out minerals and allowing it to go to other countries and create jobs there. We need to beneficiate here at home. Those, I think, are the things that we need to do. You, Doctor, you actually said we must check if departments are contributing towards the demand of the NDP. There is one simple thing that departments can do to us, whoever. Pay small business within the city. They are not doing it. And we come and lament. We don't hold these people to account because that is the most serious crime of all, each of us. Because while we try, we use the resources to create small business, people don't pay them within 30 days, they go bankrupt. You know what it happens? If it goes bankrupt, it means we are reversing the economic growth, one. Two, there are many people, labor, who will go without salary, who will be retrained. Increasing the number of unemployment hours, increasing poverty. How are we going to do this? Two things. Three things. It is ourselves. You know, if we hold the department to account and they do what they are supposed to do, private sector will have to come to the party. They will have no option. But now they can stand and write articles, see things in the papers, whatever. They're not helping us. So I think as Parliament we must take that responsibility. Use the tool that we have, the Public Finance Management Act. Hold people to account on a quarterly basis. We must know what the monies of the state are doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. And two concerns, and I'm going to just refer back to the debt, the public debt issue. The one, and I think it's not one of you, the Honourable Member, right here, but about the cash flow. That's one of the concerns. You know, we talk of the debt is the one issue, but cash flow in this country, I'm not so sure whether we are in a favourable position, because if I look at what's happening in the provinces, then the common response you get is that there is no money to do this, no money to do that, so that's the one. But regarding the public debt, the responses given by the members of the FSC, I would tend to agree, and I agree that yes, maybe the percentage is not a good yardstick, but then you need a good businessman, because any good businessman uses other people's money to make money, and that's the situation we should be in the country. And yes, we do have a good business plan, because otherwise you wouldn't have got the money, you wouldn't have been able to borrow money. The problem, I believe, is that this business plan that I'm referring to is the next NDP. And if that plan is implemented properly, then I think that will go a long way to getting the country out of the situation we find ourselves in.
Sure.
Quick
response. I think the first one, Honourable, I think Honourable Chairperson was coming, so I will take those comments. Honourable, I think the first one on the cash flow position, I think maybe Wendy can actually respond to that. But I from where I see it, I mean, we just come out from a budget council meeting 2 weeks ago, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't see anything in the numbers that were presented that basically suggested that we have a problem with cash flow. But I think Wendy can actually respond better to that. I think the second one, I agree with you. If you have to manage this, you have to know what you're doing. It's as simple as that, because if you don't know what you're doing, you just think that I think I almost went into quite some detail around how you check it, you should be looking at it. So I'll agree with you. We really need to have a very strong position around how we are actually going to, how we are actually going to manage. And as I would say, it's more about the one thing that I didn't want to respond to, try to avoid responding to, is the issue of credit rating agencies. I think between me and my fellow commissioners and my research director, we lost faith in credit rating agencies because of what happened in the run-up to the global economic collapse. I mean, there were countries that were like up there because of that. You know, you'd be aware that they even had to be taken to court in the United States for
misleading the market. So we should not ignore them. We must know what they think. We must try not to get bad ratings from them. But sometimes they really confuse things. They overreact. They don't finish. So it's an issue that we must think about. Of course, it's to know how someone feels about you independently. But you can't actually run your economy so that the credit rating agency that you are very good. Otherwise, the Ireland should actually be a second and the quarters of people in life.
Because we
people don't pay the municipalities for electricity because they can't afford it, so they're poor. Municipalities can't pay Eskom, so Eskom raises the taxes and makes it even more unaffordable. So we're just going around in a spiral. Somehow we need to address that issue, in my opinion. Human settlements, the land ownership registration aspect, as far as I understand it, basically a provincial competency. But, you know, there's always a cost. And the cost of registration, the cost of paying conveyances to do the deeds office work is a very real thing. And where does that cost from the line? Because the poor people who are wanting the land registered in their names, those who've been given properties, I know I sat on the adjudication panel for some years with Department of Housing, and when an allocation is made, then it takes another 5 or 6 years before the title deed is produced. It's unacceptable. If this could be sped up, it would save a lot of money, because that delay costs a huge amount of money. We need to address that issue somehow. Then water and sanitation, I didn't see anything specifically on that. It's one of the mandates of human settlements, is to provide water and sanitation. Water, as we know, is one of our basic human rights, access to water. I don't think we do enough in empowering municipalities to provide the water. That's the cold face. The people who live on the ground who need the water, they look at the municipalities to supply it, and we're not facilitating that sufficiently, in my opinion. Then just my last comment on the Municipal Demarcation Board. I noticed in this nice coloured brochure you gave us, just having a quick look, I see that the cost, or the estimated cost, when the merger took place in Tshwane was 1.04 billion rand. Now, that's a huge burden to put on the taxpayer for the sake of having a metro. Surely, if you're going to take existing municipalities that are efficient and are working, and then you join them together at a huge cost, it's counterproductive. Okay, we want to achieve ultimately the global city region, perhaps, but is there some other way we could approach it without it having to cost so much money? It's not just confined to Tshwane. I know it was the same in Buffalo City, it's been the same in Mongaung. It was also a huge cost involved, and great dissatisfaction and unhappiness among the people involved, because it ends up in a big fight in the councils. Isn't there some better way we can address this and implement it more cost effective? Thank you, Chair.
Thanks.
I don't know whether we should be looking into that.
my gut feeling is that we should actually do that. Because just assuming that nothing is taken, you know, there are certain community and the poor community, and then determining the thing that we better support the school. It hasn't worked, and it doesn't work. So the question of food security, it's a serious problem. It's a serious problem. But what is referenced by what is being reported, that South Africa is wasting 9 million tons of food a year. But we have families of Gohan. Perhaps it's not the question of shortage of food. It's the question of how we distribute the food that we have in a manner that we have given. I think we need to look into that. And lastly, shepherding the cost of electricity. It's not just a matter of individual households being squeezed out of disposable income for consumption for other items. But also it's one of the biggest costs of doing business, both for big business and small business. And I think we need to look into that and see. Between now and the time we achieve the goal of having other forms of energy, diversifying our energy needs, what needs to be done? Is it really necessary for the cost of electricity to be going up every now and then, and then cause not just problems for households, but also affect the economy in a very big way. And therefore, instead of energy becoming a source contributing to economic growth, it becomes a source of depressing the economy.
Important for them, just like they are equally important for
other entities. So I think it's an observation that I share with you, but I think we can do more to especially to carry that. Now you made reference to the issue around water and sanitation, and that we didn't address water and sanitation here because we dedicated quite an amount of space in our submission that you made last year. And similarly, on the issues of human settlement, the issues that you raised, we also we had published a report in November last year, I think that's when we tabled it, which was based initially on a very comprehensive set of public hearings. I think we had two public hearings around this, and then we took all the information. So the issues that you raised, we actually addressed them in that report and certain recommendations that have been made. We tabled that in Parliament. So I think if we need to come and have a discussion with the committee on that, we can also come back. Now the issue of the quintal system, this is a matter that I can tell you now that as a commission we lost, because exactly the challenge that you are raising is exactly the challenge that we raised with the Department of Education a long time ago before they became basic education, because this issue of quintal and what they were trying to do. And one thing that I'm curious about that came out of our conference is that the Deputy Minister of Finance basically said we must reopen some discussions around some of the past recommendations of the Commission. And I hope that some of the challenges that we are faced with now, that as a Commission we have foreseen that particular point and next recommendations against some decisions that we're taking are coming back. And so we won't celebrate to say, no, I told you so, but it's something that we need to actually look at. And I think it was a submission that we made in 2005 or 2004 that actually addressed this particular matter. And I remember the meetings that I had that were unending. Let me ask Ramos to you start with the first two questions that came in the previous set of questions, and then Mr. Dow will be able to respond to the issues around the transfer and the TPP.
Yeah, okay. Now coming to your initial question, we actually not just responded to it because we focused on the macro issues that wanted to come to we essentially agree with you that this is a complex issue where one of financing may be one of the peripheral issues around issues of skills. Now, I think what we've argued in the past is the distinct mismatch between people that are getting out of the system and requirements from the employer, which talks to the issue that you were talking about, that expatriates has come into the country a month or 2 months thereafter to get jobs, which suggests that not necessarily in the absence of jobs. But I think the other complexity to the problem is deliberate discrimination that the labor market actually has for business reasons. And this is not discrimination along the racial or gender line, but discrimination along what part of the age cohort you belong to. The labor market is not to discriminate against inexperienced young job seekers. Maybe for them it makes business sense that they don't want to employ somebody without the requisite skills. But then the system is failing, you know, that your youth unemployment is rising, not because these people are necessarily uneducated. They could actually be educated, but because of the way the industry works, it discriminates against that group of people. So, again, the question is, do you throw money at it, or do you address the failing of the labor market? And how do you do that? And I would think the efforts towards wage subsidies and all that attempt to go beyond it being a money problem to actually addressing the source of the problem. And I think we had a similar kind of conversation when we met for the first time, where in our assessment the issue was more the quantum of the subsidy and the likelihood of the behavioral change on the part of the employer to actually see it in their interest to substitute capital or machine with this new kind of relatively cheaper source of production, which is a youth labor. So that's where the game will be won or lost, i.e. the size of the subsidy itself, and then the behavioral change for the employer. Now, for whether the problem is financing or mixed-use development, again, it would be a bit of both, but in our recommendation last year on better education and training colleges, that trend is just a three of previous year submission. What we picked up also spoke to issues in quality of output that are coming out of that system as a result of funding below baseline and then missing the output set out in the overall plan. Of further education and training, which suggests that part of the problem is management, and the other part may be financing, where certainly for infrastructure purposes for further education and training, we saw that they were operating way below the baseline expected to generate the requisite output that they started in their own performance plans. So the question is quite a difficult one. On a rough weighted scale, I would say financing the money piece of it is a problem in certain areas, but a small part of the problem. The big ones are affecting the industry side, the office to make it want to absorb this unemployed resource. The wage subsidy, the problems there are the quantum of it and whether it can really affect the substitution between machines and people. Now, coming to the question on who should who computes the wastage that we spoke about in the health sector. We spoke of chemical waste, behavioral waste, and so on. What we've done in the technical report accompanying the submission is we've characterized these wastages into those three categories for up to last year. I would say through your research team for the partnership, when you do go on top of that duty to put ask them to update the categorization of the different waste areas, it's a pretty costless exercise to do, as long as they can get their hands on the different performance reports of be it a hospital or a whole department. That information can be titled in that sort of a format, the way you say it, in which aspect of the West do I want to focus on when I'm doing the oversight? But it will involve the work before the oversight is categorized. That it will show how to do it in the technical report accompanying. Then the final one we had not picked up was from Honorable Edinburgh, where he mentioned that we are throwing things to the local government, but they only are getting around about 9% of the transfer for that purpose. Again, to come to this issue, we issued out a report on the local government fiscal framework, and it grappled with this kind of an issue. But the long and short of it is that report found that they have kept on the vertical capital financing. So when you take all the capital financing across the three fields, they are gaps. But for recurrent expenditures at the local level, the gap is non-existent to be extremely small. So again, to answer the honorable member around financing for local government, one needs to unpack it into the capital component and the recurrent component. I was just short. No major problems with the recurrent asset of it, but generic problems with the capital aspect of it, and in fact, not just pertinent to the local government, but also across the two other spheres. And we went to some extent to try and quantify that respective gap.
Just to respond to the two questions, one on the triple fees and the one on transport. At the moment, there's very little information or data that has been collected on triple fees. We don't know, for example, how many triple fee arrangements there are in government, whether they're succeeding or failing, and if they are failing, what are some of the reasons. So the research that we have, one of the findings that we our recommendations basically are pointing to say, let us assess exactly is the current status of triple fees and what identify what are some of the shortcomings in terms of why there is not an increase in uptake of triple fees. And I think in such an assessment, the issue that you raised about over-regulation could be one issue. There could be an issue of skills, for example, legal skills that could be lacking as well. And I think from our perspective, triple P is an important vehicle for service delivery in local government, and therefore it is quite critical for these blockages to actually be unblocked so that it can actually be leveraged to improve service delivery at the local government level. The other issue in terms of transport, we did a first A of the study last year, and one of the findings that we found was that there's actually a lack of investment in capital and road infrastructure has actually been declining over time, and therefore there's basically a need to recapitalize many of the roads because they are either in the CPO or they're actually quite old and they need to be repaired. And one of the challenges that we found was that there are so many different entities that actually deal with transport. You basically have Sunrail on the one side, you've got Transnet, you've got provinces, national, you've got local government that all have to deal with this issue of transport. And if you look at a local government level, we know that municipalities are responsible in terms of the National Land Transport Act to manage an integrated transport system. But unfortunately, most municipalities are unable to achieve this simply because there are different actors that are taking decisions on their network. And if municipalities and if our research is basically calling for stronger enforcement of that role of taking charge of actually the decision that takes that gets decided on the network. So if there's a need, for example, to change the way that we're actually transporting goods, consumer goods from rail to rail, then municipalities would be in the best position to actually play and make that decision. And not as what we are finding at the moment, decisions are being taken in isolated modes. And therefore, we actually have a situation like the member pointed out, where we have underutilization of whatever capacity. So I think what we are calling for in the research is a stronger role for municipalities in terms of managing the network and also taking decisions so that we actually have optimal utilization of all modes of transport into an integrated network as what policy requires.
Okay, for other members, let me thank the trustee chair. I'm sorry, Jerry, you are very quiet today. Just let me clarify. Other office, thanks for coming. You want to say something? Okay, that's easy.
Yeah, just a few seconds. I think the reason why I'm so quiet today is because we as authority actually listen and actually get feedback also from what the committees are actually getting out of the recommendations. But just maybe to clarify our role also in this respect, it is national government that responds to the recommendations and not national police. So what happens in the process if there's policy-related questions that deal with another department, we refer to that national department for them to deal with. And if I can make a recommendation to this committee, what can be quite useful in your oversight role is actually to pull those national departments and actually get their views on how they're going to actually deal with the policy recommendations. Because what we can do from our side is fund the policies that's in existence. We can't use the funding system to change policies. And that brings us to the question also of some human settlements. That's a book line, I'll give you a bit of feedback as to what's happening there. And then just with regard to the specific question also asked on the provincial cash flow, just maybe 2 seconds. 60% of provincial budgets are actually personnel, so how they manage personnel is quite important. But what provinces also do, they're not very good at cash flow management or cash flow management projections. So, for example, what provinces indicated for 2013-14 is that they're going to overspend by 6 billion. In reality, they're underspent by 6 billion for the 2013-14 financial year, which is information. But about 2-3 years before that, it was a bit out of control, but we've actually improved our monitoring as well in that regard. And then just on the electricity issue that you mentioned as well, and the debt that was going to Eskom, if I can ask the committee also to just give a bit of a written input in this regard, because one of our units in National Treasury do monitor actually the debt owed by municipalities to both Water Board and to Eskom, and so I can get the information.
Thank you.
I just hope
you are fine. You are still absorbing. I know, you know, the intellectuals, they don't like rush to talking. They absorb that, which is good. We will, Chef, come back to you. But I think as a committee, we'd like to go through this during our own time. But sometimes it's not easy to understand the health agreement, which is just a PowerPoint presentation. Mm-hmm. It's important that we go through this. And we will also, as a committee, carefully look at your recommendations so that at the appropriate times, so at CDPS, but particularly the Division of Revenue, where we agree with you, by the way, to support those recommendations, where we have difficulties or disagree with continuing. good work, that really has assisted us to move forward. Even issues around your proposal on the transitional grant, I'm aware how Swami suffered some aging with those who say to me, and they were really interested. Look, we are really like 2 billion right now. We got this area in and nobody's assisting us. So I think we will also watch the demarcation issues now, because it might be other areas now with property. I know April, there was a proposal that it might take in, it might be the same problem where a municipality decided it has to spend money, never budget before, and they run into bigger problems. But those are the things we will look at. I think you have really applied your mind to these issues. For other members, let's take the FSC. This one?
Yeah, I
have the previous one in my office. Can we get it to other members? But if you want to go back, you can always ask. Because it's also helpful to look at the yes. Yeah.
Just a quick one, I want to speak to the market. We know that the effect when we talk about demarcation, I think the election, we only use the finances, but we're using the
Okay, so we are fine. I see you are looking at you are okay. Just to quickly, honorable members, we have an invitation here from Association of Public Accounts Committees. They're having a conference at Fund City on the 27th to the 25th of September. We are invited to participate. The theme is enhancing oversight while ensuring quality service delivery for all citizens. I've asked Darren to circulate it to yourself. Look at it if you are interested. To go so that if you are, we can apply to the House Chair for people to attend. I've already stated I will be available that week, those days, but if there are members who want to attend, we can apply for you to attend. But look at it first. The third thing, they will be building a strong capacity in the public sector, enhancing administration, enhancing coordinated oversight for better accountability, the place of ethics and values in the fight for transparency, financial accountability in the public sector, conducting oversight over the extractive industry, enhancing impact oversight in local governments. It's about those kind of issues that we will send it to you. And we will meet again next week, Tuesday and share the meeting that we have planned for tomorrow and also Friday. So we have agreed that on Tuesday we will meet with National Treasury. You hear that we need you on Tuesday to discuss the first quarter report. I said to Darren, there's no need to go to the